this is a new one I'm working on, so I haven't even got a title for it yet, but here goes. She took in New York, Manhattan. She gazed at pubescent bellboys preening their sardonic smiles in Art Deco elevators. She hailed yellow taxis transporting antediluvians in a Fifth Avenue frenzy where architectural veils hung between cold comfort sighs and impotent bureaucrats pillaged the heartbeat of a stranger. She rode subway and graffiti, trajectories of complementary colours, heroin haunts and self-pity. She ascended the Empire State, where axioms of Machiavellian protagonists regress into mutinous deliverance of rhetoric and bile. She took in 42nd Street, bizarre exhibits of reluctant modernity and jazz at the Half Note in Greenwich, two blocks from Breakfast in Tiffany's and the stench of dead fish. Out to the Jersey Turnpike, she lay beneath carillons of songbirds, savoured by the bourgeoisie, and then, where she scattered her flecks of despair, she took in New York, and New York took her.
When I was coming up tonight, I went to get a poem to read, and now that I look at it, I think I actually read it here, maybe the last time. So, but if I can't remember having read it here, you'd hardly remember. So, it doesn't really matter. Anyway, this poem is about, I suppose, we all have, I think most of us have these older male relations in our lives, you know, whether it be grandfather or uncle or father who have this philosophy of life or a theory of how to live, and they like to impart it to you. A number of times, but the funny thing is, a lot of times they have never actually lived by, they haven't lived by this philosophy at all themselves.
That's why they're all flawed now.
In certain cases, they seem to have lived by the opposite philosophy almost. This is what this poem is about, and this relation I'm going to talk to you about as well. I suppose he was the kind of personality who he never travelled, but he thought he knew everything about the world. But in a funny way, you know, the world did come to him, kind of. So there's kind of positives to take from these people, but you have to listen to them with a critical ear. So that's what this poem is about. It's called My Granddad on a Sixpence. Lift up your head. Peep from underneath the covers. What should I wear today? The uniform of the Queen's Guard? Or the mantle of an emperor called back from the fields to save Rome? This valley and village gave me my lookout across history. I've met the world's men here. From royal doctors to long-forgotten heroes of the Mesopotamian Wars. 6 weeks in London and a few days in Clarendon was enough for me to see both sides of any coin. Those blackguards of Republicans. The righteousness of churchmen. The silliness of women. Find the knight and hitch your star to his wagon. While I stay here, awaiting your return.
My very oldest friends were allowed to call me Charlie Clark. Look, this is a poem about a film. I don't know, probably very few people have ever seen The Assassination and Death of Trotsky by Joseph Losey, which this poem is a little more recent than the film. The film is not very recent. Trotsky in Mexico. Did you like Burton in the Trotsky film? Very few did, it appears. A world revolutionary playing with rabbits, correction, feeding them lettuce. Kindness to the young is done for. Mexico is a country of extremes. Peasants, pushers, Zapata, Fox. There is no bread pudding in Mexico. They have bullfights. Joseph Losey makes too much of that in his film. Could one deny the perverse poetry of the ice speech? A most unlikely weapon, but fit for purpose. They meant to crack through his skull. He was an intellectual, an egghead. The once impulsive leader of the Red Horde, checked outside Warsaw in 1920, struck down by Stalin's henchmen in sultry Mexico, was slower, not wiser, and he met his fate.
Next, you have the wonderful Mary O'Connell.
Okay, this is a memory of Sid Barrett, who got burnt out when he was playing with Pink Floyd, but that was because of LSD, I think. And it's called Fade Out. A star too bright for northern latitudes, his incandescent glow lit up the earth before he flared and fizzled out of sight, opening a void. The acid boost supposed to fuel his gift began to melt the wiring in his brain, as if he too explored the eerie wastes that lay behind the dark side of the moon. He never made it back. His shaken band members, caught off guard, could only crawl out from the shadow cast by their afflicted friend. They watched in disbelief as he tuned out on reaching interstellar overdrive, this erstwhile piper at the edge of dawn. His wiry body became soft and slack, then grew bloated like a swollen husk. They let him go, unable to coax back the easy smile, or start the dynamo that powered his eyes with that magnetic pull. The lights were quenched behind an empty stare. 7 years later, in a wild lament, they wished that he could join them in their song, begged this crazy diamond to shine on. Thank you.
Terrific as ever, Mary, thank you. Next up, we have a Flavor Challenge winner, Richard.
This poem's title and its final two lines come from Dante's Inferno, Canto 26, and the translation reads something like this: "You were not fashioned to live like beasts, but to follow virtue and knowledge." So the sonnet is called Fatti non fosti, you were not fashioned. Fatti non fosti, in memoriam Wallace Orr. Although not very taken with the saints, that last trip to Ballyvorney, you placed your whole arm inside St. Gobnet's church wall to reach the relic of her bowling ball, revealing that an old man's heart has room for Dante's Paradise and David Hume. You brought the farthest matter near to us, praising the Georgics by a kitchen stove. Your hand retreating from that cavity now shades you in a distant apple grove. Through you, arcing gently back to Munster, Odysseus' voice fills Ballyvorney. Fatti non fos da viver come brutti, ma per seguir virtut e conoscenza.
Talked about Trotsky. I had something published many years ago. Just came to mind when you read your piece. It's can't remember the name of it, but anyway. In August 1940, Stalin sent Mercator to Mexico City to open tentative negotiations with Trotsky to break the ice, so to speak. And this is a haiku, 575, but it's based on a longer work. It's called Paradise Lost. The black cormorant squatting in the tree of life plots our giddy fall.
Recently separated, and he's going to play a cricket match, and his son is coming to watch, and his sweet drives down and picks him up. So this is the morning of the match. I jump out of bed and pull on my whites. My head is full of Peterson's batting and romantic thoughts and excitement at seeing Alex. After a light breakfast, I jog down the four flights to the underground car park. I drive out into a bright morning, only a few wispy clouds drifting overhead. I listen to the build-up to the fourth day's play on Test Match Special. As I approach Castleknock, however, the voices on the radio fade. Aside from the mechanics of driving, I become unable to concentrate on anything outside myself. My stomach twists with every turn the car takes through the streets of my old neighbourhood. My thoughts become variations on the same pep talk to myself. Don't let the conversation go anywhere. Always polite. Never warm, never cold. A hint of brusqueness, nothing raw. Don't give her anything. This is weaponry from the passive-aggressive arsenal, to be sure, but I don't have much in the way of choice. Her is Aisling, my wife of 12 years. We will be divorced soon enough. She left me for a man called Steve, but that is to give him too grand a role. He didn't break up a healthy marriage so much as shamble in and collapse a rickety one. This does not make me hate him any less. I clock his slinky old Toyota Corolla parked outside the house. Why is that car such a special provocation to me? As I walk to the door, I scrutinize my car key, like a tennis player dubiously inspecting the strings on his racket after a bad shot. I ring the bell. Let Alex answer, I think. Let Alex answer. I suspect Steve has moved in, but I don't want to know for sure. I only agreed to move out in the first place for Alex's sake, and because I was so cut up back then, I didn't have the appetite for a standoff. But if I knew Steve was living there, I might feel goaded into a fight. Aisling appears through the beveled glass of the side light. £220 it cost, my main contribution to the house's decor. She opens the door and smiles, and I look past her into the kitchen. My eyes dart around in an anguished search for change, but everything is as it was when I moved out. "Alex, your father's here," shouts Ashley. "One minute," answers Alex from the back of the house. We stand in silence. She's wearing a vest top. Her neck and chest sport their full complement of freckles despite the poor summer. There is noise on the stairs, and down trundles Steve, dressed in whites and tossing a cricket ball from hand to hand. He looks me up and down. "Ready for battle?" he asks. My brain scrambles for perspective. Don't tell me he plays for our opponents. Please no. He does. He's wearing their cap. He must have joined them recently then, or else I just never paid any attention to him before I knew he was sleeping with my wife. I do not answer his question. I want him to acknowledge the difficulty of the situation. But Steve has an easygoing persona to uphold and a woman to impress. So, prancing through the minefield of cuckold sensitivity, he throws out a joke. "Wow, I like the new mirror," he says. He steps to the left so that he is directly opposite me, looks into my eyes, and brushes his thick hair with his hands. Ashling honks like a seal. He's only 3 feet in front of me. I could stop her laughing, break his nose, and stop him playing, all with one well-aimed punch. How much would one punch jeopardize my access rights with Alex? When our hooting abates, Ashling fixes me with a disapproving stare. That is all she can do. She too must bite her lip, having ceded powers over me. I watch as her laughter crumbles into silence. Alex comes running through the kitchen, into the hall, and the two clowns parting to let him through, out to me. He has a radical new haircut I decide to ignore. "Say goodbye to Mummy," Alex, I say. "See you later, sweetheart. Have a nice time," she says. I look at Steve. "See you there." Steve nods. I turn and walk to the car and wait for Alex to join me. The time has come, I reflect, to embrace my status more fully. Next time I pick Alex up, I'm staying in the car and blasting the horn. That's it.
Next up we have Cedric.
Well, that one will be a three parts, but the two first are actually rather short. First one. Perdition is what turns us into ourselves. Second one. It is how hard you whip back after you yielded that says how firm you truly are. Third one. Love is a bad loot. He yelled at her like a violated treasure. He let his heart out, took the weight of it off his chest, and threw it at her face. She dug it out after all, completing a treasure hunt that would only turn into a trap, as she got closer to the prize. As every good pirate worth calling, she relentlessly sought the shiny hidden jewels through the scorching hot sand of his personality. And she was now crying over her now burned palms and souls, holding his heavy gold, stranded on an island of unbalanced love. There's a reason why some things are only buried.
Thanks, Cedric. And last but not least, tonight we have Rab.
how's it going? This is a found story, and I found it in my notebook and I've forgotten all about it. Oh yeah. 3:20 a.m. Murphy awoke to the sound of his phone ringing. Better get down here quick, Sarge. The station's on fire. He dressed quickly, hopped into his car, and blue light flashing, siren wailing, topping 240 kph, made it to the village in 12 minutes. He pulled into the square, fire engines, smoke and flame. The station was well lit. O'Brien approached. That was quick, Sarge. Aye, the Ocarola still has a fair ton of speed now. What's the story here? Patel over the square there called 999 about 20 minutes ago says you heard a bang and looked over, saw the flames and called emergency. They called me. The fire crew were here when I got here. Any ideas? Hard to tell at the moment, Sarge. Probably still being ablaze and all. Chief, Sergeant Murphy, how are they? Here as well as can be expected, seeing as my station's on fire. Any ideas? The lads are still damping down, but my first impression is that somebody poured a load of petrol through your letterbox. Made any enemies lately? Petrol? That is my initial impression. We'll start the forensics tomorrow, but for now I suggest you scare up a carpenter and block up the windows and door. Okay, thanks, Chief. O'Brien, yes, Sergeant. Get on to Finbar Manning, tell him to block the door and the window. And O'Brien, yes, Sergeant. Tell him not to disturb him. The forensic team will be here first thing. Will do, Sarge, no problem. Murphy got back into his car and drove slowly around the village. Blarney had changed. The 500,000 tourists who visited every year wouldn't really notice. Well, apart from the few who had their bags snatched and were robbed of their expensive cameras and knife point. In the last few years, heroin had taken over.